You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. We are finally here. I know it's been a long week waiting for an episode for those of you that actually wait with bated breath to listen to the podcast, but whew, what a week. It's been a wild one for me. So anyway, we are back. I brought along my good friend Troy from the Not a Bomb podcast. Troy, how you doing?
Howdy, partner.
Yeah, there we go. And if you haven't picked up on it right away, we're actually doing a classic Western, five-card stud from, I believe it's 1968.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, it's 68.
Hey, look, I got excited when you said we're doing a Western with Dean Martin and Robert Mitchum, so I'm like, I'm in.
Yeah, so this is one that I saw Vinegar Syndrome put it out. I know you picked it up. I did not, but I remember thinking at the time, I probably should because I had never seen this.
Oh, this is a first-time watch?
Yeah, I'd never seen this film.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of classic Westerns, but this one I do not recall. I would have remembered the Mitchum performance in this, definitely.
Okay.
And I would have remembered a few other things, but I didn't. I thought maybe I'd seen it, but when I started watching, I was like, I've never seen this. So good to check one off the list every now and then.
I remember buying it on DVD for the first time and going, I've never seen this. And then when I sat down to watch it, I'm like, oh, I've seen this. My dad showed me this movie. So
Yeah. Yeah, this was one that, I don't know, somehow it eluded me for a long time. And then I saw Vincent put it out on their, their Vinegar Syndrome Labs label or something like that. And
oh, I thought it was just a, I bought it. But
yeah, it's a Blu-ray, right?
It's a movie that I never thought would see this kind of treatment. So I was pretty excited.
Yeah. Well, that's the great thing about the boutique labels, right? That's what makes them so special is they do things like this for us. And those of us that love movies, we love that. So that is what we're talking about. I have spoken to Will. For those who want an update, he should be back sometime soon. He's got some things, like I said, going on. He's getting those kind of ironed out, and he should be back. We got some really good stuff coming down the pipe. We've talked several times about what we'll be covering. I think folks will be excited. Got some good stuff. I don't know what we're doing next week for sure, but Troy might be back. We've kind of talked behind the scenes. So
I'm here for you, buddy.
There you go. Thank you. Appreciate it. This is the great thing about having podcasters is for friends is that you're like, hey, man, what are you doing? You ever seen this?
I really like the discussions that go back and forth on what do you want to talk about? I mean, the list that you kind of threw out there and that I gave you some hits to, it was all over the place.
Yes.
But I'm really glad we landed on this one. I was super excited.
Yes. That's always interesting. And I think a bit daunting for people a lot of times when I say, well, no, pick whatever you want. And they're like, I got the double whammy of doing this forever and having covered 1200 and something films. So people have to ask questions. But again, a lot of times there's so many movies. A lot of times we haven't covered it. So we get some interesting lists and some interesting thoughts. We almost did Jackie Chan. I know that people probably are taking they're gasping right now.
Well, it's his birthday month, man. Yeah, yeah.
They're wondering why we didn't do a Jackie Chan film. Well, you know, we love Jackie. Maybe we don't cover enough Jackie. I don't know.
That would be my opinion. Yeah. Yes.
Maybe we cover too much Sammo. I don't know.
No, that's, I don't think you can do that.
We do cover quite a bit of Sammo though.
And I'm fine with that.
That's
why I love the podcast.
Yeah. I think the Jackie thing is just, it's just timing, or it's just, I don't know. I think it's, we've avoided a lot of them because of the popularity of Jackie himself, but shame on us. We should do more. And we would.
No, I like the fact that you guys are highlighting some films that, I mean, you're absolutely right. The Jackie Chan filmography, especially from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, overshadow a lot of the great Hong Kong films, especially from one Sammo Hung. So I'm really excited you guys champion those films, even though I do love it when you and Will talk Jackie Chan. Those are my favorites.
Yeah, we love talking to him, so we'll get back to it at some point. But yeah, I remember when we started this podcast, we were like, we got to talk about Gordon Liu, man. We got to talk about more Gordon Liu films. We got to talk about more so, you know.
And there's never enough time.
There's never enough time to talk about these guys. So Jackie kind of took a back seat. Not that he should have, but he just kind of did to it. Some of our cult heroes.
I totally understand, man. Totally get it.
Yuen Biao being one of them, oddly. Again, another Jackie. It seems like we do every... Anybody that works with Jackie, we got you covered.
I still love you guys. I do.
All right. So that's what we're doing. Let's get into some stuff we've been watching lately. What have you been up to? You been watching anything?
Well, surprisingly, I've been watching some Jackie Chan movies because every year, April 7th, we have our big Jackie Chan Day.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And that's two days before my birthday.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. We do a huge, well, typically what would happen is it becomes like a 10-hour marathon. And I love the fact that after so many years, my family embraces it. Unfortunately, this year, just due to schedules and everything else, we could only squeeze a couple in. But I also have got to the point where I've got work celebrating. So we do a big luncheon and birthday cake and everything else. And it's a lot of fun. So I picked a film out and Tabitha picked a film out to watch of Jackie's. So one is actually inspired by something that you watched recently. And I had to go back and revisit Hand of Death from 1976.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So speaking of Sammo Hung with some wacky teeth.
Yes.
I think you said it best. Like it's a kung fu film that I think gets overlooked, but man, it's a really strong kung fu film.
It's really good. Yeah. I think it does get overlooked.
Yeah. I mean, it's your typical, you know, Shaolin revenge plot. But it has all of the staples of a great kung fu film in terms of interesting villains. It has that section of the film where you're getting a couple of protagonists to come together and it just feels like that Magnificent Seven moment to a certain degree. And the fight choreography is really good. You get to see Sammo, a young Sammo, and a very young Jackie Chan with, I don't know what he's trying to do on his face there. I think he's trying to grow a mustache. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
But it's just a good movie. It's a really well-made, good film.
Yeah.
And every time I forget John Woo directed that thing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the other thing. It's a good John Woo film. It's not, you know, Jackie's there, obviously. I think he ended up having some surgery, I think, or something at some point, right? To kind of do some stuff with his eyes or whatever and whatnot later.
Yeah,
Whiting. Yeah, it's
whiting his eyes, more Americanized eyes. Yeah, I guess you could say
it's a bit of a dark thing that sometimes happens in that industry. But what I remember coming away from the most though was Tan Tao Ling or Ling Tan Tao Ling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember coming away from that thinking, man, that guy, he should have been a bigger star.
I think so,
and I think he's kind of overlooked.
So, yeah, there's a lot of people in this film. There's a lot of good choreography, but I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
I think it gets recognition now because of Sammo, Jackie, and John.
Mm-hmm.
But the entire cast is fantastic in it.
Yeah, it is. Yang Wei's in there as well, and Carter Wong. If you look closely, Carter Wong's in there. the The interesting thing about that film, I remember watching the commentary on that disc, and they say if you watch it closely, Yuen Biao's in there too. Everybody's really dressed up. Yeah, everybody's keeps dressing up as different henchmen.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, it's fun to watch, and it's a solid film. It's pretty violent too, if I recall.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And then my wife, so this is her favorite Jackie Chan film, and I gotta say I love it too. I love it because of two big things. And I'm talking about Gorgeous from 1999. So this is Tabitha's favorite film, and I think the reason why she loves it is because of one Brad Allen. For those who don't know who Brad Allen is, he is one of the few non-Asians, if not the only non-Asian, to be on the Jackie Chan stunt team. So he has a really interesting background to where, while they're filming, I think it was Mr. Nice Guy was the film that they're filming in Australia or something of that nature. Brad Allen, you know, comes up, meets Jackie, shows them the reel, etc. And just as a result of their interactions, he ends up getting a job working on the stunt team. And Gorgeous is one of the few Jackie Chan films that, as much as it showcases Jackie Chan's incredible choreography and ability to kick people in the face, this movie is all about Brad Allen.
Yeah.
And when you see this film, you totally understand why Hollywood went to him for some sort of big budget action films and used him as a stunt coordinator. So for those who don't know, some of the bigger films that Brad Allen actually did choreography on would be Scott Pilgrim versus the World, Kick-Ass. His last film that he worked on was Marvel's Shang-Chi. Unfortunately, after that film, he died of a heart attack at a pretty young age, like in his, I want to say early 50s.
Yeah, I remember it was unexpected. It was a shock.
Yeah, but I love it because it showcases Brad Allen. But the other thing I really like about it is if you watch this film and you watch something like Miracles or any of the Project A's, you really have an understanding that Jackie Chan has a huge appreciation for old Hollywood. And Gorgeous, to me, just feels like something that is akin to Miracles, which when Jackie did Miracles, Mr. Canton and Lady Rose, I mean, it's actually a remake of an older Hollywood film. So Gorgeous is just a romantic comedy through and through. It has just some really great performances from Tony Leung. He shows up in it, Shu Qi, et cetera. But it just feels like that 40s, maybe 50s screwball comedy with Brad Allen and Jackie Chan taking time to kick each other in the face.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really have a villain or an antagonist, kind of like those 40s comedies. It's just, you know, it's just this goofy Shu Qi is out there following a message in a bottle, stumbles onto Jackie Chan, and it's about them developing a relationship and all this stuff kind of happening around it. But it's crazy for this film that was made sort of later in his career, you know, late 90s. It just feels like Jackie trying to recapture, recreate those movies from the 40s and 50s that I know he loves.
Right, right. Yeah, I remember I've seen that a few times. I always look for Stephen Chow. I always overlook him. I
think has a great cameo in it.
Yeah, he's in there as well. So,
yeah,
it's pretty great.
So those are the two Jackie Chan films we got in this year. The other thing watched over the last week on our show, we're celebrating Ape Roll. Get it?
Yes.
Yeah. Apes.
Good job.
Monkeys, stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So while I kind of got in my head that for every movie that we watch to talk about on the show, so this week we did Monkey Shines. I'm like, well, I'm going to squeeze another one in and something I haven't seen before. And I know while I was watching this, I was texting you and Jose and Brad because I got to tell you, this movie just blew my mind. I didn't even know it existed, but I picked it up for like a dollar. And it's Queen Kong from 1976.
Nice.
I think you can watch it on Tubi with ads. But before you do so, the only way I can describe it is if you were to take the music from Grease 2, because it does have musical numbers, and I know you're sitting there, Sammy, going, well, that's amazing. It's not.
I'm in.
No. Grease 2 is a terrible film.
I'm in.
Take that along with some of the deadpan humor of Airplane 2 and mix it with special effects from like Son of Godzilla. That's exactly what you get with Queen Kong. It is a film that as soon as I finish watching it, I'm like, well, if we do a season 2 of Breaking Brad, that is definitely going on the list, because it's rare you come across a film that you just want to torture people with. And this is definitely one of them. It's so terrible. It is absolutely terrible. They pretty much take the King Kong film and remake it with a feminist twist to it. And it feels like a really, I don't know, calling it a dollar store version of a Naked Gun film is just, that would be a compliment in terms of how poor this film is. But man, it's something to be seen. So, and then I think the last thing I watched, just because when we started talking about doing this film, after I watched this, it got me immediately into a Western sort of vibe. And so I wanted to watch a Western I hadn't seen before. I think you had seen this before. I may have picked this up because you have talked about it, because there's a really good Paramount Blu-ray release that came out of this, but it's, I think it's 19, is it 59? I think it's 1959's Last Train from Gun Hill.
Yeah. Yeah. I know this one.
So Kirk Douglas and Anthony Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
The other surprise in this one is there's a woman in here.
Yeah.
Carolyn Jones.
Did you recognize her?
So as I'm watching the film, I'm like, man, I know this actress from somewhere. I know it. So I'm watching the entire film. And have you watched an older film like this where, you know Kirk Douglas, you know Anthony Quinn, you're loving the heck out of this film. And I got to tell you, it is an amazing film. It's become one of my new favorite Westerns now. But I'm watching this lady and I'm like, man, this is bothering me. I know who she is. And then you use the internet and you're going, oh my God, that's Morticia Adams.
Yeah. Yeah. Carolyn Jones. Is that her name?
Jones. Carolyn Jones. Yeah. Yeah, I got to tell you, the highlight of this film is Kirk Douglas. He does this monologue about what it's like to hang. And it is the most intimidating speech that could come, I think, from just a guy who's driven to revenge. And the whole plot is his wife is raped and murdered. And so he goes to this town to basically get the guys who did it and bring them back. And he captures one of the, I think it's Earl Holliman, plays the son of Anthony Quinn. And he's the one that did the murder.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, Earl Holliman is telling him, oh, you're going to die. You're going to do this, that, or the other. And Kirk Douglas, to get back at him, just, you know, because he's a sheriff, tells him what it's like to hang. And it's, I don't know, it's a good 3 or 4 minute speech. And it sent chills down my spine. It's so, it reminds me of how good Kirk Douglas is, to be quite honest.
Yeah, that's a John Sturges movie. So
yeah, it's so good.
Yeah, I mean, he was a great director. And I'm pretty sure Kurt Russell's dad's in that film.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, I think Bing Russell's in there.
Oh, yeah. There's the Paramount Blu-ray is fantastic. Leonard Maltin does like, I don't know, probably a 10 or 15 minute special feature on just the making of it. There's such great tension between Quinn and Douglas. But then when you read about, or excuse me, when Leonard Maltin is talking about the making of the film, and he's like, these two did not get along at all. And he goes back and explains it like they're both trying to make a Spartacus film at the same time, et cetera. But the shooting was a bit, there was tension on set because of these two didn't like each other. That translates on screen really well. And again, if you haven't seen this film, I just encourage everybody to watch it. And if you're like us and you're a big media collector, I can't speak high enough of that Blu-ray, because the thing looks like it was shot yesterday. That's how good it looks.
Yeah. 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 I need to rewatch that. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I love John Sturges movies.
Yeah. They're so good. Yeah. But yeah, that was my week.
It's a pretty good one. It's a pretty good one.
Yeah. No. Well, I would say no duds, but Queen Kong, well, I'm going to make you guys watch it the next time we're all in the same room, to be quite honest.
Okay. And I'll say, okay, I'm pretty sure I've seen it. And I remember thinking, Jesus, this is bad.
It's terrible. I mean, even they do like a Jaws parody where a rubber shark shows up.
No. I've definitely seen it. Yeah. It's god awful. It's a bad movie. Terrible. Yeah. It's a bad one.
Yep.
I watched a few things. Finally caught up with The Zone of Interest, a little lighthearted fare.
Oh, I heard that's a great romantic comedy.
Yeah. It's got songs like Grease 2. So, oh, no. Anyway, this movie is really well done, really well shot, really well acted. Everything about it is really well done, but I can see why some people don't really care for it. It's very glacial. It's very slow. There's a lot going on. I mean, if the thesis of the film is to show you the mundane lifestyle of coming home from work every day and people living their life while living next to a death camp, it succeeds at that very well. And it's almost weird. It's almost like Fassbender-like in some ways. It's definitely worth a watch. I can't say it's amazing, and I love Jonathan Glazer films. I loved Under the Skin. I know I like that more than you did. I love Birth, which I watched not too long ago. This one, I liked it a lot, and it's beautiful to look at, but it's a tough subject, and it's pretty harsh at times with some of the stuff. And some of the visuals and stuff, it's a real subtle look at how awful this event was, and I really appreciated that. There's this one scene in the movie. This is not a spoiler. There's this one scene in the movie where they have the Jewish people that work for them too. They work there, you know, they're prisoners at the camp, but they also work within the house of the commandant of the camp. So every day they will bring goods in, fur coats, nice shoes, watches, things like that. And then you realize these are all from people that just got burned or gassed and burned. And they're going through these items and they're just nonchalant, like, oh, this is crap. And I'm just sitting there thinking, Jesus, that's powerful. I mean, it's really a powerful moment. And there's a few moments like that. It's a really good film. I would recommend people check it out. But I would say that it's, oddly, this is one that I don't even think I could rewatch much. It's just, I don't know, made my stomach turn a little bit. Isn't that weird? Well, say for me?
No, I know you like your change, guys. When I heard about it, I want to see it, but I feel like I got to be in the right state of mind.
Yeah, I was in the right state of mind when I watched it, which is a good thing. But it's probably my least favorite Jonathan Glazer movie.
Yeah, I just the whole concept of taking something like that type of atrocity and really fitting it into just a mundane day.
Yeah, a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, that sounds more horrifying than some of the more, I don't know, Hollywood takes or versions of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
To understand that there was a group of people that was just like getting up and going to work and there was no big deal to it. I mean, that to me is like one of the scariest things ever.
Yeah, there's a moment, I won't mention it because it's a bit of a spoiler, but there's a moment that's just god awful. And it's all done with audio. And it is rough. It is rough.
Wow.
And I just thought to myself, this is just, ugh. But I mean, if the thesis is to show that dichotomy,
yeah.
I mean, he nails it. I don't know if it's got a lot of rewatch value, but he nails that experiment he's going for. So I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. Some parts of me really liked it, but ugh. And it gives me chills talking about it because it's just kind of, I don't know. I guess if there's anything in cinema that, you know, I'm not really turned off by gore anymore. You know, we watched The Sadness together and stuff. We all just kind of laughed at the gore, right? Because we've seen so many gory films, but this made me feel like dirty in some weird way. So it was very odd, very odd viewing experience. Great sound.
Like the sound design and everything.
Yeah. For you, you're really going to dig that part. Because even
oh boy. It's not an Atmos or anything, is it? Or?
I don't know if it is. I have to go back and look, but I don't know if it is.
There's some of those films where they don't show anything, but what they do with the sound design, especially in a good theater setup, I think it gets to even more.
Well, it's like that when we've reviewed Mother. That's what I thought of Mother.
Oh, yeah, Mother. Oh, my God.
There were moments of Mother that's when I was looking behind me. I was like, what is going on?
Oh, yeah. That you cannot underestimate just how sound can heighten, you know, those experiences.
Yeah. And it just envelopes you. It just sucks you.
Absolutely.
Yep. Rewatch Flatliners in 4K from 1990. Good old Flatliners.
Wow.
Random rewatch. No reason whatsoever to rewatch it. I just thought.
Oh, wait. This is the day when I asked what Jackie Chan movie you were going to watch.
Yes.
And you said, no, I'm opting for Sutherland in 4K.
Yes. Somehow. It actually was. It shows here on my Letterboxd, the date of April 7th. So, yes.
Yeah, that's some bullshit, man. You give Warriors 2 and 8, and then on Jackie Chan's birthday, you watch a Keith for Sutherland. I mean, talk about the biggest like middle finger to Jackie Chan. That's terrible, man.
Not even a great Kiefer Sutherland film with that.
Jeez.
Flatliners is interesting though on a rewatch. When's the last time you saw Flatliners? Have you ever seen, or what have you? I'm sure you've seen it once.
Oh yeah, no. It's I remember seeing it a couple of times in the theater. Just because it was a little bit of that water cooler movie for our age group when it came out.
Yeah.
I got to be honest. I don't think I've watched it again since the VHS days.
Yeah. So this is a weird movie to watch. This movie is all style. It is all style, pure through and through. Almost to the point of annoyance. It's shot by Jan DeMont, and he really just goes for it here and just does.
I remember it looking amazing, but I just don't remember anything about it.
Now it still looks amazing. It looks aged because it does some things that they used to do, but none of the lighting sources in the film make any sense at all. And the whole logic of the movie is completely off the wall. Not the dying and coming back. That part's not as off the wall as the rest of the movie. Everything else is so off the wall. It's unbelievable. And for that, it was fun to kind of rewatch it and kind of see Schumacher just kind of, it just looks like he was just kind of having fun. And it's just like all style and very little substance. I guess one of the things I liked about watching it was this is Julia Roberts pre-superstardom. Mm-hmm. And she's becoming a star. Actually, I think she became a star while this film was being made, I believe. And that was really good for Flatliners, obviously. Man, she was beautiful. I'm not saying she's not beautiful now, but wow.
I've always felt she's one of those actresses that I think she looks amazing now.
Yeah.
But there's not a point in her career. And I think it's a combination of, it's not just her looks, but it's that personality that comes through too in her roles that just makes her that much more attractive.
Yeah. Yeah. She's really great in this. I switched gears after that and watched, Kiefer Sutherland's good in the film too. Everybody's good in the film.
Oliver Platt's in that too, right?
Yeah. Oliver Platt and William Baldwin, one of the Baldwins.
Yeah. That's right.
And Kevin Bacon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Kevin Bacon had a few duds after Footloose. People forget this. And he became a little bit of Hollywood poison for a little while.
That's right. Yeah.
And he started doing background roles in other films. And he really kind of ended up making his bread and butter doing that kind of stuff, really, because that's really, I mean, he still does starring roles, but if you think about it, Kevin Bacon's always kind of the other guy in a movie nowadays. So, you know, this is kind of one of those Kevin Bacon performances. But I mean, they tried to make him a huge star, right? So, what else did I watch? I watched The Wrong Missy. Now, this is an Adam Sandler produced comedy that's on Netflix with David Spade. And I can't remember the name of the actress off the top of my head.
Did you watch this on April 7th as well?
I did.
God dang it.
Lauren Lapkus, who is way over the top in this. Troy, you and Cam got to watch this movie. This movie is pretty fucking hilarious.
Is it? Because we're on a stupid comedy kick right now.
It is one of the stupidest comedies I've ever watched. It's so stupid, I couldn't stop laughing.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
that might go to the top of the list.
Oh, because
he's really interested. He wants to watch Deuce Bigelow and the sequel.
Yeah.
Was it European Gigolo or something?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, that's next up on our docket.
Rob Schneider's actually in this one playing a shark tour guide. that takes people out. And he's on one hand, he's only got a thumb and a pinky. And he's always looks like he's saying hang loose, but that's because the shark bit him. And it's pretty, dude, I laughed a lot, a lot.
Oh, boy. Okay.
And I don't, you know, a lot of this stuff doesn't land for me sometimes. It's a very loud kind of comedy, but it's loud anyway, but it's hilarious. I watched Bray Wyatt Becoming Immortal. This is a documentary. It's on Peacock about Bray Wyatt. He passed away unexpectedly. I think he's only 35 or 36 years old. Kind of a fun, interesting wrestler, creative guy. My son was a big fan of his and stuff. I just wanted to watch it and see what, you know, see some things. Kind of made me cry a little bit. So wouldn't recommend that if you're an emotional person. And then last but certainly not least, I watched a little film that just kind of came out of nowhere called The Greatest Hits.
Oh, okay. I've read about this one.
This is interesting. This is a movie about a lady who loses her boyfriend. And she had such a deep connection with him that when she listens to music, if she listens to a song that she had a connection with her ex-boyfriend or her widowed boyfriend who passed away, she can go back in time and relive that moment. And the whole movie is her trying to change things. So the time machine logic is completely out the window. She's constantly trying to change things for the better, for to keep him around. The kick is that if she does it, she won't ever really be in love with him. She'll never really know him. So that's kind of the whole kind of plot of the film. So it's kind of an interesting prospect. And it's essentially a sci-fi romance, which is what this is. Typically not a genre I watch a lot of. So I wanted to watch something kind of different. And this is quite different. I don't think it sticks everything it goes for, but I like the idea. You know, sometimes I feel old. And when I really feel old is when I watch a movie made by a younger filmmaker and they put songs in there. And I'm like, what's this song? Do you ever have moments like that?
Too often, man. I feel like the old guy in my yard just yelling at the clouds, like, who is singing this? Yeah. This is crap.
She'll put an album on, and I'm like, who is this? Who is? I need to look at the soundtrack. I don't know who this is. It's not very good, but who is this? there's some house music here and stuff. I don't really listen to house music and stuff. I mean, the music's fine. It's just not my thing. The performances are really good. I don't think it completely sticks what it's going for, but I thought it was kind of sweet and kind of nice, and it wasn't too kind of schmaltzy. A pretty good love story in there. So
Tabitha knows I'm not a huge fan of smoochy films. Yeah. Like, give me people getting kicked in the face. So she's always looking for something that has an angle to it. So I think it was one of those, like, read this. It sounds kind of interesting. So I read it as like a time travel love story. I'm like, okay, I might be down for that. And I haven't heard anybody like say anything negative about it.
No. I the only thing I would say about it is it's like slightly above average. It's good. It's a good matinee type film, or maybe a good film to watch if you want to stretch your legs and get outside of the genre cinema you watch sometimes. It's a genre that I know a lot of us don't watch a lot.
Right.
It does have time travel in it, so it does have some interesting elements, but, I liked it. I thought it was really, I guess the best word, and this might not be pumping it up too much, but it was really nice. It was a nice film.
You need a nice film every once in a while.
Yeah. It was nice to watch a nice film. It's very nice. But yeah, that's it. That's all I watched. I've been working on a few other things, trying to get them in, but man, this week has been just kicking me in the can. Whew.
I feel it too, man. Yeah, I feel it.
We talk about this. For those who don't know, behind the scenes, we've talked about this several times on both shows, on three different shows,
yeah,
that we have a text thread between four of us, and all of us have been taking a beating, I think. Maybe Brad hasn't. I'm not sure if Brad's been taking a beating.
Doesn't go to work. What are you talking about? He just sits in his basement reading his X-Men comics, playing with his X-Men action figures, watching Quentin Tarantino films.
This is why you go to college and specialize in certain things, folks. So
and he's really good at it. He won like
so you can be Brad
Auditor of the Year or something. I wish I was Brad. I want his schedule.
So you can be Brad. Hey man, yes. Nothing wrong with that. Good thing to live up to be Brad.
I agree.
I tell my son,
no BS, man. I look up to the guy.
Yeah, I tell my son all the time, that's the kind of job you want. You want a job where you're needed, not where you're.
I mean, he's good at it too. Like, he's the dude's super smart.
Yeah, no, he makes me sick.
I really I don't like the fact that he's so good at everything.
Makes me
like,
sick. I think I want him to think I want him to sit on my face.
Yeah, you have to listen to our show for that reference, I guess.
There's a lot of face setting talk. More face setting talk than I ever expected.
I look, when it shocked me too, revisiting Monkey Shines. But I'm telling you, I just had a totally different take on it this time around. And yeah, that quadriplegic sex scene came out of nowhere, and I was not ready for it. So,
yeah, it's something. I won't talk about my opinion of Monkey Shines. I mean, maybe we'll cover it someday and stuff. I'm kind of like you, though. I mean, I'm not going to give anything away. I don't take the angle completely you took, but because you took an angle. You took a stand. I like it.
Hey, look, nothing gets me more jazzed up than like bonkers movie science. I mean, that's why I like movies like Brain That Wouldn't Die and stuff like that. So when they commit to it, I'm all for it. But I got to tell you, watching that film now, I just have a total, as what showed up in our text thread, it's the me boo movement. So boo the monkey. Alan in that film is a dick, and I side with that monkey all day long. So
to let another behind the scenes moment, to let everybody know just how close we are, as we are recording this, Jose is watching Monkey Shines right now.
That's so, and he's only watching it because we had told him, there's like this naked stretching scene in the beginning of some guy that he loves. And of course he's like, I got to own the Blu-ray in high definition and watch this guy stretch naked. Yes. That's a total Jose moment.
Yeah. So he's giving us the play by play. So this is what I'm subjected to. Not only reviews of Monkey Shines, but we are subjected to the play by play as well.
Yeah. Five a.m. I may get up at 5 a.m. and I've got a text waiting for me from somebody. Yeah.
Something about John Pankow's ankles or something.
Yeah. Something weird.
Something weird. Okay. We are going to take a short break. Sorry, no feedback this week. All that kind of good stuff. Just kind of trying to get an episode out here. It's been a bear, so I'm just trying to get one out, but we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and we're going to discuss this 5-card stud movie from 68. We'll be back right after this.
Five card stud. The stranger's game was five card stud. He was hard to beat. Rather play than eat. Long as it was five card stud. When he played for blood. When this rambling gambling man said, deal on. Better beware. Bet your poke and he'd leave you broke. Then he'd make a joke as he slyly grinned. Then he'd say, that's enough today. And he'd ride away like the wind. Stud was all he lived and breathed. But now I'm gonna fight.
All right, everybody, welcome back. So, here we are, a Western that I haven't seen, and a Western that Troy has. I watched this, I'm just going to be honest, I didn't watch this on physical media. I didn't buy it. I'm thinking about that, doing that now, obviously. This is sometimes the case, but I watched it on iTunes, just rented it. So I think I watched it in standard def. Still looked really nice. I know you watched it on Blu-ray. So this, we'll talk about that transfer and how it looks and everything here in a bit. 5-card stud. 1968, directed by one Henry Hathaway. Now, that name may sound familiar to some of you film fans, and it probably should in a lot of ways. I mean, he directed quite a few films, 67 of them in total, and a lot of them pretty popular films at the time. He did True Grit after this, and did Nevada Smith, which is a pretty good Steve McQueen film if you've never seen it. Sons of Katie Elder. How the West Was Won. He did some segments in that and quite a few other things. A lot of kind of guy adventure films, you know what I mean? Kind of like, you know, those kind of 50s and 60s kind of just you know, thrillers. They weren't really action films, but you know what I mean. Just kind of.
Well, he did some. I mean, film noir, Kiss of Death.
Oh, Paul, yeah.
Northside 777. I mean.
Yeah, no, he did a Tyrone Power film I love called The Black Rose with Tyrone Power, yes, and Orson Welles. Yeah. Yeah.
He has a really interesting filmography. Like when you see that name, I only recognize his name from The Sons of Katie Elder because I love that film.
Yeah.
But then, well, I always forget, like, there's this whole film noir run that he did too, which kind of makes sense when we talk about this film.
Yeah. Yeah, he, you know, I mean, he finishes up his career in some ways with True Grit. He makes, another film after that, a couple films after that. So, but yeah, I mean, he worked a long time. And I think he did a little bit of stuff in Airport as well. It looks like he did, yeah.
Yeah, uncredited, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. Didn't know that. A lot of good stuff here. A lot of good stuff. You can't go wrong with most of these films, actually. Most of them are at least entertaining. If not funny titles, Knob Hill is pretty funny.
Oh yeah. It's title of my sex tape.
And he's a workman director from way back in the '30s. So, you know, this is back in a time when people would make, you know, like in 1933, I think he made five or six films.
Yeah. I mean, would you classify him just pretty much as a studio director?
Yeah. A workman's just studio director. I mean, he made a lot of films with, I know he did some Randolph Scott stuff, some early Randolph Scott stuff like that, just old school westerns and stuff. And you can't really go wrong with that stuff. I mean, if you're in the mood for that kind of stuff, it's really good. One I know that I always kind of laughed at the title. Another one I think it's got a funny title is, what's it called? It's, I don't know if there's anybody popular in it, but I know the cowboys in it were named Porky and Tex. And here it is. It's Under the Tonto Rim.
Under the Tonto Rim.
Yeah, I saw that film before, and that's it's got Fuzzy Knight in it. It's got a bunch of old school actors. Nobody's superstar. Stuart Irwin is a star. Fred Kohler. So you get kind of what I'm talking about. A lot of hour long westerns. You know, B movies that, you know, like my grandfather would have probably paid a nickel to go see back in the day. So a lot of that kind of stuff. So you kind of got to be in the mood for that kind of stuff because it's not like the Westerns. It's not even going to be like the Western we're going to talk about tonight, to be honest with you. Because this is in a lot of ways, this is a very modern Western. So this movie stars Dean Martin, the great Dino himself. I don't know if there needs to be anything said about Dean Martin. He was a huge star, not just a film, but, you know, songs. And he just had a very cool factor to him. I won't go into his filmography too deep here because he's got a lot, but I love Dean Martin. He just, something about him just seems kind of laissez-faire for what he just seemed like. He's always really comfortable. I don't know if I buy him all the time as a rootin' tootin' cowboy, but you know what? I'll go with it. Robert Mitchum's in here as Reverend Rudd. We got, I can say a lot about him as well. He's a GGTMC favorite. Very interesting guy. Inger Stevens here is Lily Langford. Roddy McDowell. In a bad guy performance, which is that was kind of odd for me.
And this, I guess, the timing of this is after the Planet of the Apes, right? Because he was getting some critical praise for that one. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this is definitely a deviation from what people had seen, just from an acting perspective.
Yeah. And we got some great character actors that pop up in here too. Not least of all, Yaphet Kotto is in here as Little George, bartender.
That's pretty
cool to see Yaphet Kotto in here. Denver Powell, the great Jesse, Uncle Jesse Duke, is in here playing Sig Evers, and a bunch of like just B movie actor cowboy guys: Bill Fletcher, Whit Bessel, all kinds of folks like that. John Anderson plays the Marshal Dana. These are all guys that have been in a ton of cowboy films. So this movie I had never seen. You had seen before. You kind of picked it. I don't know if you want to lead on talking about it or what. If you want me to, I don't care either way. But, there's some talking to be done here.
Yeah, no, I would love for you to take the lead since I feel like I jumped off when we talked about Roadhouse. But I do have a question for you because you and I have very similar backgrounds. I feel like we lived the same life for the most part, but I'm really curious because you and I just have a love for Westerns. Where did that come from for you?
This is a good question. I've kind of talked about it a little bit over the years. It mostly came from my grandfather. My father did like them as well, but my grandfather was the one that really liked them. As a matter of fact, he liked Western so much, he wouldn't watch anything else.
Okay.
So it's, you know, one of those things where it had to be, you know, white hat, black hat, typically guys on horses dealing with issues in the town, or he wasn't really interested in watching it. That's just kind of what he liked. But what I do remember about my grandfather that I find interesting and is probably one of the most formidable things that or at least the thing that really formed my opinion of Westerns is my grandfather always liked the bad guy.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. He would always say, you know, ooh, that, you know, I was a little kid and he would say, ooh, that dude's bad. That dude is bad. And stuff like that. He really got into the bad guy performances. So the more over the top or the more insane the bad guy performances in these Westerns, he liked them more. So he eventually would like, you know, he was alive when, you know, most of my youth. And so he saw the Dollars films and stuff, and he loved Lee Van Cleef. And he would tell me that guy was in High Noon and whatnot. And he always had a bad guy face. And I remember picking up on that. And you know, he loved John Wayne films, because everybody did from that generation.
Right.
But he loved Tom Mix stuff. He loved Gene Autry stuff a lot. He loved that stuff. That, you know, that's, I gotta say for the record, I appreciate that stuff, but that is not something the singing cowboy stuff never has really worked for me.
It's, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I remember watching that when I was younger, and I didn't mind it, mm-hmm. but it was at a time when I really just didn't appreciate Westerns.
Yeah. Yeah. In the genre itself, I mean, I don't know if you've seen the Coen Brothers Ballad of Buster Scruggs or not yet, yeah. but there's a little bit of that singing cowboy kind of tribute in that. It's Coen Brothers-esque, but it's in there. And they've done that kind of, they've kind of harped on it over the years, but he loved that stuff. We watched a lot of, you know, like Tarantino. He's a little older than us, I think a decade older than us, but I grew up watching a lot of TV Westerns too. There was a lot of television Westerns growing up, and a lot of that stuff was in reruns by the time I got old enough to really pay attention. So I'd come home and watch The Rifleman, or I'd watch Rawhide, or I'd watch Bonanza, or any of those type programs. I'd watch those. Wanted Dead or Alive with Steve McQueen was a favorite.
That was my favorite.
Yeah. Would watch that. And I think honestly, that one was my favorite because I like McQueen so much, but I think honestly, pound for pound, I think I might have liked The Rifleman the most. I really like The Rifleman a lot. Chuck Connors. I really like that show.
I think when I discovered Steve McQueen, I latched onto that television show because
Steve McQueen, Chuck Connors, totally different ball game. But but I, all those things I remember. And then what's great about Westerns is they cross into eras, and then the 70s, late 60s, and the 70s happen. And now I'm older, and my dad and my grandpa aren't as cool as my uncle is. And my uncle is really into Clint Eastwood stuff. And so now I'm watching all the 70s Clint Eastwood things and the 80s Clint Eastwood stuff, Pale Rider and Josie Wales and all that stuff. And you know, it keeps happening, my love of the Western. And now it's kind of come back around again. They're mostly low budget now, but I don't know if you've recognized, but there's a ton of low budget Westerns being made right now.
Cynthia Rothrock has one in like post-production.
Yeah. I have no idea why so many of these are being made right now. I don't know if they're hoping they'll catch on. There's been some really good ones in there actually, but, they are making a ton of these things.
So yeah, the other question I had is like, for me, my father was the one who introduced me like to Westerns all the time. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he was like your grandfather where that's the only thing he would watch, but it was his favorite. And especially John Wayne, Robert Mitchum. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I watched El Dorado.
Yeah.
And that was probably one of my favorites that we would watch together, but I wanted nothing to do with Westerns because, you know, outside of like maybe Stranger and the Gunfighter, nobody was doing the martial arts and stuff in them. Right.
That's a good point.
So, I don't think I really appreciated Westerns until college. And it just became sort of this guy thing where every Sunday we'd be like, well, what Western are we going to watch? And then I took a screenwriting class because I was doing the English major thing. And a lot of the screenplays that we would study for form and structure were Westerns, like High Noon and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I just became this, I don't know. I just fell in love with it again because I started to appreciate how many different stories could be told within that genre.
Right.
But then B, it just kind of solidified that connection between me and my father. But I didn't like Westerns until later in life. I didn't know if you had that initial reaction where you loved it when you were introduced to it, or did you have to come around on it?
I loved them when I was introduced to them because I was allowed to watch, you know, at the time I was getting to watch a lot of guys getting shot and, you know, tough guy stuff. Yeah. I went through a phase where I didn't like them at all. Mostly in my teen years, I pretty much turned away from them for the most part. Got into horror quite a bit and everything else. Thought Westerns was an old man's game. You know, I was a teenager.
Sure. Yeah.
And just kind of got away from them and stuff. And then again, like I said, my uncle kind of turned me on to it. Actually, my mom, too, I should give my mom some credit, too. You know, I've often talked about this on the show. She's a bit of a Charles Bronson fan. And one of her favorite Charles Bronson movies is Once Upon a Time in the West. And she's the one that kind of turned me on to that film, which I saw that when I was really young. And I really didn't even I mean, that was such a shock, that movie. I love that movie now. I think it's a masterpiece. But that was such a shock of style and form and everything else that I couldn't even comprehend what I was watching at the time when I watched it. The music was weird. The way it's shot, the way it's quiet. I was just like, this is the opposite of everything I like.
Yeah, that's true.
But I've come to, you know, quite love that and all that style that comes into it. But yeah, I think, you know, as I've gotten older, I've appreciated that this is a genre that you can mix everything into it, you know, and we should say, I mean, that's what we're going to talk about here tonight, because this is not just a Western, right?
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. I mean, it's playing with a couple of genres, to be quite honest.
Yeah. There's a little bit of a romance angle, but for the most part, what it's really kind of playing with is the murder mystery. This is really almost like a Five Little Indians.
Yeah. I was going to say, when I watch it, there's two vibes that I guess it comes off, and this is why I've seen it a couple of times. Like I really like this film, just full disclosure. Mm-hmm. But it reminds me, it's a studio Western, but there are elements in it, and specifically in some death scenes, that feel like it has that Italian giallo feel, right? So there's a barbed wire strangulation, there's a hanging in a church, and the way they film it, you go, wait a second, is this a giallo? Because you're right, it has that murder mystery aspect. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at the director, and then you take a step back and go, well, this kind of has the structure to almost film noir. And I don't know if you've ever seen that Charlton Heston film from the 50s, Dark City.
Yeah, I know what it is.
I mean, this is pretty much Dark City, but just as a Western. So it has the Western look and the Western feel, and it's a studio Western, but underneath it, you get some film noir, you get some Italian giallo elements to it, and it's super unique. And I think even when it comes out in its time period in 68, there, just real quick, talking about the Blu-ray release, the transfer is amazing. There's a fantastic booklet inside of it, and it starts off talking about it. When you think about Five Card Stud, you have to remember that 6 months earlier, people were just exposed to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So that comes out in December 1967. Then Five Card Stud comes out in July 1968. And then the next big sort of cultural Western film that comes out is The Wild Bunch in 69.
Yeah, yeah.
And this kind of sits in between it. And those three Westerns really, I think, don't feel like your traditional Westerns. And they kind of redefine the genre a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, they do. I mean, some of those redefine cinema altogether.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So this Western probably would have been, I don't know this for a fact. I know on your guys' show, you kind of go back and look at box office and everything else. I don't know if this was a hit.
It did okay.
Yeah. I know
it was modest.
Yeah. I know it's, you know, it's pretty much a programmer, a type of picture. I think it's what Roger Avery calls him over on the Video Archives podcast. It feels like that. It doesn't feel like a big star. You know, I mean, Dean Martin's a pretty big star still at this point. Robert Mitchum's still hanging in there. But You know, it just feels kind of like a B Western in some ways. And I don't know. I think that it's kind of weird. It kind of sets in between such kind of Mount Rushmore type Westerns. And there was a lot of that stuff still being made. I mean, they were still making Westerns, but Westerns in America were dying for the most part in the 60s. And only certain folks were keeping them alive. Sam Peckinpah, mostly himself, really kept them, you know, kind of rejuvenated them in a lot of ways. Yeah. So that was the interesting thing about it. But I think, you know, we need to talk about one other name we didn't mention. And I don't usually mention the names of producers too much, but this one's got a pretty big name on it. And that's Hal Wallace is the producer on this one. Now, Hal Wallace has produced, I mean, the list is ever going. It's like, it's almost 400 movies. So I can't even begin to tell you. I can tell you that, you know, he did quite a bit, but if you just want to go back and look at it yourself and kind of scroll through, you're going to be like, wow, that is one hell of a resume. I mean, everything from the Maltese Falcon to, you know, which is way back to, you know, stuff like I Walk Alone, Dark City, which you mentioned, he did that one as well. And even late side, Gunfight at the OK Corral, which is an amazing one. And, I think anyway, Rooster Cogburn was the last thing he did, but I mean, this guy just has tons. Elvis movies, everything. You just name it. He did tons of stuff. The Furies, which is a great Western that a lot of people, I think Criterion even put that out, on a disc. I remember they put it out on DVD. I don't know if they've ever released it on Blu-ray or not, but they did put it out on DVD. And I remember I always wanted that DVD set and I never bought it. It's one of those ones that I missed somehow.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. So the time that this movie comes out, the year before Easy Come, Easy Go, he produces that. Barefoot in the Park is 67. Mm-hmm. He does Five Card Stud in 68 and True Grit in 69.
Yeah.
And then Anne of a Thousand Days, which didn't it get nominated for Academy Award? That one?
I don't know. I've never seen Anne of a Thousand Days.
Yeah. I thought Best Picture. Yeah. Nominee.
I think he did one of the first versions of Moby Dick. I know that.
Yeah.
Which is crazy to think about.
He's certainly a powerhouse producer, man.
Yeah, 1930.
That's crazy.
Moby Dick, yeah. Anyway, yeah. Powerhouse producer, one of the great producers in Hollywood history, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. I mean we're just skimming like the very surface of his filmography. I mean, I'm just scrolling through and I just keep scrolling and there's like just movie after movie after movie.
Isn't Casablanca on that list too?
I think so. I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I think Casablanca, okay. Yankee Doodle Dandy's on there.
Yeah, I mean, these iconic Hollywood films that if you were to take a film class, you're going to run across this guy's name, you know, eight out of 10 times if you're looking at these films.
Yeah, High Sierra's in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Didn't you just see High Sierra recently?
Mm-hmm, I did.
Yeah, yeah. Because you had never seen it before, right?
I had never.
Came away a High Sierra fan, right?
I was. There's every time Brad and I will talk about something, because I am amazed at how much Brad has seen. Now, it's like everything, right?
Yes.
I'm amazed what you and Will, the amount of Italian films you guys have seen, yeah. I'll never get to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like I probably have specialized more in the Hong Kong like 80s and 90s. I've tried to see everything.
Yeah, everybody has a hill they die on. And
yeah, and film noir. Like I love film noir and ninja films. Like just these little subjects. But I'll run across something and Brad will be like, "You've seen this?" I'm like, "Man, that I should have seen that if I like movies."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just saw Lawrence of Arabia for the first time like a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, you can only. I tell people that all the time. They say, well, I'm not going to mention any movies because you've seen them all. And I'm like, you'd be amazed how many I haven't seen. It just seems that way. It just seems that way. You know, and speaking of that Wild Bunch thing, it should be said that Mitchum turned down that lead role in Wild Bunch to make this movie. And I often wonder if he regretted that or not.
He was going to play the role of Pike, right?
Yeah, he was going to do the William Holden part, yeah. Yep. Which that role pretty much saved William Holden's career for the 70s. Gave him a career.
Let's be honest, I can't imagine anybody but William Holden in that role. I mean, I love Mitchum, but William Holden was born to play Pike.
Yeah, yeah. There's just something about William Holden as that character. And talk about one of the great Western character names, Pike Bishop. I mean, that's an amazing name. But anyway, let's get into this film proper. The synopsis is the players in an ongoing poker game are being mysteriously killed off one by one. So there's, I believe, is there five gentlemen or six gentlemen at the card table? Maybe there's more than that. One, two, three, four, five, six. I think there's six or seven at the card table. I can't remember how many. Anyway, so the film starts pretty standard. We get a card game. We find one gentleman is cheating. A lynching happens. Our lead, Dean Martin, doesn't really want a lynching to happen. His character in the film, Van Morgan, is kind of a ne'er-do-well professional card shark kind of guy, but he's got a code, and that code is, you know, he's the good guy, essentially, in the film. What's interesting about that is I think they're playing with it a little bit because he wears a black hat, and the preacher wears a black hat, and I think, obviously, that's a bit of a statement that's going on there because, you know, the preacher character is an interesting character in this film. And I'm not going to, you know, we don't really spoil stuff on this show, so I'm not going to give away the twist of the movie because I kind of knew where it was going. It didn't surprise me. I think I was more surprised by, well, I was surprised by the violence of the movie, quite frankly.
Yes.
And I was surprised at the, I don't know, I think I was surprised how much I enjoyed Mitchum and Martin together. I didn't expect that. I didn't expect that that kind of charisma to ooze between them like it does. It really works.
It's funny you say that. So, again, there's a lot of information in that Blu-ray release, especially in that booklet, but I copied this line down. So Lee Server, who was a Robert Mitchum biographer, he had dubbed Martin and Mitchum as Hollywood's two deities of indifference.
Yeah.
So if you think about the traditional roles, you go, okay, these two guys on screen probably should not work as well as they do together in this film. And I also think it's kind of funny. I mean, you know, I talked about El Dorado. I mean, two of my favorite Westerns are pretty much the same Western, Rio Bravo and El Dorado. And you've got Mitchum and Martin playing the same role, but just in two different films, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. What makes them so good, I think, in any film is who they're playing off against. And, you know, you put these two and they're going to be, you know, the people you're spending time with. I don't know, on paper, you're like, is that really going to work? Because they are so indifferent. They are so calm, cool, collected. Like, is there going to be spark or energy between them? And I agree with you. Like, I'm surprised how much I like seeing those two together.
Yeah, I mean, it gets to a point in the film where I just want them to hang out all the time. It does get,
and there's an element where they kind of work together.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, well, this is going where you kind of hope it goes, where there's a team up.
Yeah. No, it's pretty good. It's just fun to see two, you know, megastars team up like that. And I just, you know, on the surface, if you tell me Dean Martin and Robert Mitchum, I'm sitting there thinking, wow, that's two different personalities in a way.
Yeah.
But then I think about it, they both got kind of the same kind of delivery, kind of that, hey, what's going on there, guy? What's going on, fella?
Yeah.
You know, they both got this kind of loquacious, kind of laid back way of talking, you know? Although, you know, Mitchum is a little broad in this film, playing a preacher. He is, he's kind of a badass when he shows up, but his preaching is, you know, he's pretty, I wouldn't say completely over the top, but he's a little over the top with his preaching and some of the stuff he's doing there. There's some nice genre elements to this film. So, again, like I said, it starts out, card cheat, they lynch. So we know who the guys are that did the lynching.
Yes.
So that's the setup of this film. Now, these gentlemen start passing away one by one in brutal ways. Strangulation by barbed wire, a guy gets hung in the church. Just awful stuff. Another guy gets, I think he gets beat up or something. He definitely gets pummeled. And a barrel of flour he's laying in, which is a pretty horrific moment, actually.
Yeah, it almost looked like he was beat up and then suffocated in the flour.
Yeah, and I think that moment works because the red blood on the white flour, right?
That's why I kind of bring in that Italian giallo comparison, because I'm thinking of that where you get the red on the white background of the flour. I got to tell you, that strangled by barbed wire, when they show it, it looks grisly.
It does.
Like, I didn't know that. I always thought, like, okay, what is the worst way to go? I think Strangled by Barbed Wire might be in the top 10 now because just the way it looked, it just looked awful.
I mean, that's a pretty bad way to go. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. Strangling enough, but just the barbed wire they use and how it tears up your neck. Ugh.
Yeah. It's a little much.
Yeah.
But there's a, you know, the film, it pretty much hits on tropes, but like any good genre movie, I think it paces the tropes well. It has some kind of training montages a little bit, some gun shooting. It has card playing. It has all these little elements that work. And then it has the camaraderie that works as well. But I think what I liked about watching this is every little scene, well, not every little scene, but there are several scenes in the film that are just well acted and fun. And they're not overly serious. Like, you know, the scene between Mitchum and Martin at the shooting range is kind of fun. And you know, they're kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, they're kind of flirting with each other with what they can do with guns and kind of showing off. The scene, Martin, you know, obviously the girl in town, she really loves him. Roddy McDowell's sister, she really loves him. These two come from a rich family, the sister and Roddy McDowell, they come from a rich family. Roddy McDowell's character, Nick Evers, is kind of jealous of his sister, played by Catherine Justice, Nora Evers, who he thinks is going to get a lot more than she deserves out of the ranch. And I believe this is all owned by Denver Powell, who is Sig Evers, and keeps offering
Uncle Jesse.
Uncle Jesse, for those of us who grew up in the 70s. And as soon as he talks, you're like, hey, that's Uncle Jesse.
Oh, yeah. He opened his mouth. I'm like, oh, we're the Duke boys.
Yeah. Bo and Luke, where are you boys? You know, and anyway, he's always offering, I keep thinking to myself, he must be really rich because, you know, this is the Old West, and he's like, $4,000, $5,000. I'm like, good Lord.
Oh, yeah, it's $1,000 for everybody who dies.
Yeah.
And then four people died, $4,000.
Yeah, so he's always offering them money. So they're kind of these spoiled kids in town, and you kind of see where the film's kind of going. Dean Martin's character, Van Morgan, really doesn't like the Roddy McDowell character that much, but he tolerates him because I think he's in love with his sister a little bit. But then it throws a kind of a whammy on you because he actually isn't really in love with, this is kind of a spoiler, but not really. He kind of falls for the ex-working girl. That's more his speed, more his style.
So the sister's younger, considerably younger than Dean Martin's character.
And innocent, right? She's an innocent
girl. Yes, very innocent. And I think he knows that. But you're absolutely right. There tends to be, or what develops is this, I don't want to call it a love triangle. What I found interesting in that relationship is when the two women sort of meet up, and how they meet up is interesting. There's a shootout that's occurring in the streets.
Uh-huh.
And they're both worried about Dean Martin's character.
Yeah.
They don't fight each other. They come to a realization like, oh, well, I love this guy, or I have an interest in this guy. Oh, so do I. And they both confront him, and you think something's going to happen, but it's all just very nonchalant. Like, yeah, we know you're playing us both.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think, you know, it is weird how she kind of drops it. Like, she doesn't really get bitter about it in any way, shape or form. She just realizes that the Van Morgan character is a man of experience, and he's fallen for a working girl. And there's a great moment too where he goes to get a shave and stuff, and they have that barber sign which says haircut, like dollar this, that, and the miscellaneous, like $25 or something like that. And I just thought, oh, I think that's kind of funny, kind of a little in joke there, because, you know, it's a bunch of women in a one home. Yeah, I think you can figure out what miscellaneous means. I mean, one moment he's like,
"Well, I love how he asks about it." Yeah, like, what's miscellaneous?
Yeah, it's just a kind of a fun little moment. So the movie is not afraid to poke fun at the genre a little bit too, right? Yeah. And this is kind of what, you know, Dean Martin kind of adds to the movie. I think what Dean Martin always added to movies for me, he always felt like if he was in a Western, he felt like he was out of time in that Western. He never really felt like a Western hero to me. He always felt like Dean Martin in a Western. Now, that might sound like a criticism, but it's not. It's kind of like Elvis Presley movies or something like that. I know some of those movies aren't great and stuff, but when I go to those movies or when I watch those movies, I'm watching them because I want to see Elvis Presley. So in this regard, I'm watching this movie not only because we picked it to talk about, but I'm watching this movie too. If I'm going to watch it on my own, I'm probably going to watch it because of Dean Martin and Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, absolutely.
More than likely, that's why I'm going to watch it. And that is really the main selling point of the film. But there is a twist going on. There's these killings going on. Everybody's on edge. Life is pretty crazy in this small town. I want to talk about some of the dialogue. Some of the dialogue is pretty good in the film. There's a great moment.
I think it's fantastic. Yeah. And I feel like your comment about Dean Martin being in a Western.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say, okay, this is, his name's Van Morgan. No, it's Van Martin, right?
Yeah. I mean, it might as well be, because that's who he, I mean, he is acting. Okay.
He is. He's not just winging it.
But he is also Dean Martin.
Yeah, but that's what I like about it. I think we've talked about this before, like movie stars, right?
Yes. Yes. So Tom Cruise is the great example.
Yeah, his personality is going to come through. So he's going to play this character, but he's going to add an element of Dean Martin into that character. And they even tailor elements of the script for that to come through just extremely bold, especially in his exchanges with Inger Stevens. I love their interactions, because you can tell somebody sat down and was like, how would Dean Martin flirt with her? That's the dialogue that's going to come out. But even your analogy of Dean Martin flirting with Robert Mitchum, there's a great exchange where they're practicing shooting cans and then shooting a windmill, right?
Yeah.
And Robert Mitchum pulls his gun out and shoots his windmill and like hits all six shots.
Yeah.
And then Dean Martin tries and misses. And he's like, oh, you're way better than me. And Mitchum's like, are you kidding? I was trying to shoot in between the blades and I missed.
Yeah. That's a great moment.
It has that playful banter, which you almost feel like Dean Martin sat down and be like, well, this is what I would say in real life.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love that moment. It's one of my favorite moments in the film. I love that. Yaphet Kotto's got a great line too, where Van Morgan says, I didn't hear you say amen. And he says, I don't believe in it.
Yeah.
He's got a couple great moments in the film. He's really good in the movie. Although I will say, for the record, there's one scene where he's running across the street. I think it's a good thing Yaphet Kotto didn't run a lot in his movies, because he's up there with Steven Seagal with his running. It's not pretty.
You would think Steven Seagal was doing his stunt running, to be quite honest.
It's pretty bad. I mean, I was like, oh my God, I had to rewind it and go back and look. I was like, yikes. It's a good thing he didn't run in a lot of movies, because it's pretty bad. And then there's the great line from Mitchum too, when they talk about the dead people, and he's like, they all look alike to the worms. I love that. It's just simple stuff. And it's such macho like cowboy shit. And I love how that works. And I guess if there's one criticism about Westerns, especially classic Westerns, it's that they, you know, it is a boys genre. It's certainly a boys genre in a lot of ways. So
Drew Barrymore tried to change that with Bad Girls. I mean, come on.
Yeah. But I mean, it is men being men, and it's a genre made for men. Now, that's not to say it's just for men. Like, again, my mother loved Western. She loved the tough guy films. And one of the things she loved about them was she loved that these guys just kind of would always talk shit with each other. And it was just, you know, so tough that you're just like, whoa, don't mess with this guy. I mean, the great example is the, you know, the great line, you brought two too many, which is not even proper English. You know, Charles Bronson says that when he looks at the horses and he's like, you brought two too many.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that is amazing. Like, how badass are you? You know, now are you standing there playing a harmonica, but now you're saying you brought too many horses. And, I've always loved that stuff. So it's got a little moments like that, not on that level, but it does have moments like that throughout the film. And the dialogue is some of the best parts of it. The film's well written. I mean, the story moves along in a good clip. All the acting is solid. The mystery is pretty good. I think you'd have to be kind of goofy to not figure it out, to be honest.
Well, I'll be honest. So there's one part of the mystery you go, oh, yeah, it's that guy. Like 100%, right?
Yeah.
But how this guy's getting his information kind of surprised me. That took me off guard for a minute. So there is an element of the mystery that I think is really well done. I also like the fact that you kind of mentioned this in the synopsis. right out of the gate, there's a lynching, right? And right out of the gate, there's one character, specifically Roddy McDowall, where you're like, this guy is terrible. He's slimy. You just want to see his ass handed to him. And that's established in the first 5 minutes. And you're wondering through all of this film, when is he going to get his comeuppance? And it's really interesting how all that plays out. And I also like the fact that, you know, Dean Martin, his character, Van Morgan, this terrible thing happens at the beginning of the film. But throughout the entire film, he knows the rule, like, you know, snitches get stitches. And he never gives up anybody.
Yeah.
He's trying to solve the mystery on his own mm-hmm. without actually implicating anybody in the lynching.
Yeah.
And he wants to take care of it. And even at the end, when they ask about a particular character, like what happened to him, he doesn't tell him the truth. He just goes, well, I think this person was onto this other person at the same time I was, and he just got killed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It is. I love all the little elements here with the way the film is set up. Again, if there's anything I would say that's a drawback to the film, I don't think it's a drawback, actually. Let me rephrase that. It's not a drawback. It's just that this film is shot very standard, like a Western. It looks nice. It looks good and stuff. There is a pretty good action sequence in the street at one point with a good shootout there.
Yes. That action sequence is actually really good. I mean,
it's pretty good.
Dean Martin's stunt double does some great stuff with those horses.
Yeah.
I think it's a standout scene, to be quite honest.
Yeah. That's pretty good. No, it's pretty good. The film though is, you know, it's in some ways it's shot like a studio Western. You know, a lot of master shots and whatnot. So you're not going to get a whole lot of style here, but what you will get is very adequate filmmaking, very professional filmmaking. I love watching movies like this. Of course, I have nostalgia for this, you know, period of watching films like this, because this is the stuff I grew up on watching with my grandparents or whatnot, because I always had this contentious relationship with my grandparents. Like all grandparents, like, you boys need to be outside playing. Yeah, not in here watching these movies. And then, we'd come in at a certain time, or it'd be too hot one day or something. They'd be like, oh, you need to stay in the house, watch movies today. It's just too hot out there. Yeah. So they go back and forth with it, but you know, like all parents, you want your kids to get out of the house some, but they also understood, you know, me and my brother, to a lesser extent, my brother, but me and my brother, we loved movies. That was what we loved. And, they understood that. So they would, you know, they loved it too, because AMC was new. And that was back in the days when AMC would just play film after film after film after film.
Right.
And it was amazing. I mean, I saw so many movies that way. They would just plop them on, man. Every now and then they would do a theme, like they do Universal Horror Films or they do Westerns or whatnot, or Steve McQueen films or something like that. But for the most part, they just kind of would just churn through catalogs of old films. And I saw so many movies that way. And I can't even tell you how many films I saw that way. But I think about that all the time, about the impact of those films, because here I am now. I watch films on a really nice sound system, a big TV, high definition, highest of definition, let's be honest, 4K and whatnot. And, you know, it's an amazing experience. But the power of movies is kind of similar to the power of books in a way. It's just down to the product itself. I saw The Best Years of Our Lives on a 13-inch black and white tube TV one late night, and it blew me away. And yeah. I'm sitting there thinking, there's no sound system there. The speaker was probably as big as like a silver dollar.
Yeah.
You know, you had to crank it up halfway to get any sound out of it. All you needed was the dialogue and the storytelling and the filmmaking, right? You didn't need all that sound and stuff. And that's not to say I love sound and everything else, but you didn't need all those elements. And you still don't. You still don't. If a film is well made and the story is there and it's told well,
it adds to it. Yeah, I totally agree. Like I love picture quality, but I'm more of a sound junkie.
Yeah.
And I love when they take, you know, older films and add that Atmos soundtrack. And if they do it right, it's like seeing the movie all over again. However, you know, one of the best compliments I would give this film is, again, as great as it looks on Blu-ray, this is one of those films that, let's say it was just a black and white film, I actually think it would work really well.
Yeah.
Just strip it all of its color, and then it would be a true, like, film noir Western hybrid.
Right.
But that's how engaging the performances are. I think that's how good the narrative is. Like you said, it moves at a pretty good clip. It's not going to dazzle you with its iconic photography, but there are some interesting shots in there. Like every time they come back to the card table and they tip a chair up because that person's dead, you eventually get like this one shot of Dean Martin, just sitting at the card table by himself with an overhead shot, and you see all this green, and he's just throwing these cards out. And I'm like, that's a pretty good shot. I do like that. Uh-huh. But you're not going to see anything Sergio Leone and go, oh my God, that's going to blow me away. Like no. The ending of, like, you know, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Like you said, it's just a competently shot film. There's a couple of good compositions within this.
Yeah.
But man, you know, throw this thing mono black and white, it would still be a great film.
I think so. Again, I watched it. I'm pretty sure the iTunes copy just had a mono sound. It might have had stereo sound, but it was definitely a two-channel sound. You could tell.
Yeah, the Blue's only a two-channel, two-channel DTS mono, I think.
Yeah, which that's probably what's on the iTunes copy more than likely. It might have actually been in high definition now that I think about it. It might be the same copy that's on that Blu-ray. I don't know that for a fact, but it might be. I know Vinegar Syndrome and some of these companies that rescan these and save these films and stuff and help get them out. I know a lot of times they put that stuff on the streaming services to rent as well, you know, because that way it just gives everybody access. I mean, a good example is, like, you know, we were just talking about Monkey Shines, right? If you want to buy a high definition version of Monkey Shines right now, you got to pay a little bit of coin, because it's out of print, but you can rent it. Or actually, I think Jose's watching it on a streaming channel, like a,
for free.
Yeah, like some type of streaming channel through the Amazon thing. I can't remember what he called it. I'm going to look it up on my phone while we're talking about it. I really don't have much more to add to my discussion of this film. I just think it plays. I just think this thing plays really well.
And I agree. I would say I'm trying to think about it. Like I like the story. I like the premise. I think what sells it for me is just the blend of the genres, like we talked about, but the performances are really good. I mean, we talked about, you know, Dean Martin is Dean Martin, but I love that character. He is sort of trying to protect himself. He does care about the women in his lives, but he really wants to get to the heart of this mystery, and he comes off as sort of a cowboy detective. And I think he sells it. He really charms his way through the film. And I think he's having a lot of fun playing sort of the cowboy detective role.
Yeah.
Mitchum, what I like about Mitchum is I think it would have been really easy for him to bring the preacher Harry Powell from Night of the Hunter into this, because he almost has that same look and everything. And he dips into that character, I think, at times, but he never goes overboard with it. And he makes probably a reserved version of that Harry Powell character come to life. Mm-hmm. And I Roddy McDowell. So I've seen people go, he's terrible in this film. When you read some reviews, I actually think he's quite good in this film as sort of the slimy brother.
Yeah. He's a sniveling little shit is what he is.
He is, but he has this speech about being 10 when his mom died.
Yeah. It's a good moment. Yep.
Yeah. It's a really good monologue, kind of showing off his mental imbalance and how he views the world as a result of being beat by his father because he wouldn't cry at his mother's funeral. And so that's without that speech, I think you would find his behavior in this film a bit erratic.
Yeah.
And some of the choices he makes as a character erratic. But when he does that monologue, all of a sudden I kind of understand his character a little bit. Now, he's still a slimy piece of crap.
Yeah.
But you understand what created that person as a result of him telling that backstory. And he's really good in that moment.
He is. Yeah. I mean, I say he's a little shit, but I mean, that's kind of what he's kind of a spoiled brat kind of character. Kind of a character that's, I mean, everybody in town knows he's just a bit of a petulant child. And they all just kind of deal with him. But there's quite a few people that don't like him. And that's the weird thing about the movie, I think. To me, the weird thing about the movie is that D. Martin's still protective of him in some
ways. Well, yeah, he's protective of that group, even though what they did was absolutely terrible.
Yeah, because they even knocked Dean Martin out. We should say that. Dean was trying to stop him.
Yeah.
They give him the butt of a rifle and knock him out. They do pull him out of the water before he drowns, but they definitely were like, we're going to do this no matter what you say.
Yeah, there's this, it's a really weird, dark, unspoken camaraderie between that group.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's what's fascinating about this film is he never Dean Martin's character never turns on any of these other characters, and he could have easily done that. And there's another great scene. So another person, Yaphet Kotto, is really good in his role as sort of the bartender. And there's this scene, I love it, when they go to a funeral and Roddy McDowall pretty much accuses Yaphet Kotto of being a snitch.
Uh-huh.
And watching Kotto turn on him and give him this just intimidating stare down, it's fantastic. And watching Roddy McDowall sort of back off at that point.
Yeah.
It's a great interaction. It's really good.
It is. I like all the moments in the bars are really good. And the moments with even the conversations with the call girl, the Inger Stevens character, and Dean Martin are good. All that stuff's good. I mean, the movie's really solid. I just, you know, I know some people are going to listen to the show and be like, you know, I don't know what the best way to describe this movie. I guess the best way to describe it is it's just a really solid Western.
Yeah, it's really good. Well, it's a really solid Western with a different feel than a traditional Western.
Yeah, the murder mystery elements makes it different, yes.
Yeah, it does. It doesn't feel like your typical John Wayne film. It doesn't feel like El Dorado, Rio Bravo. I mean, it's got elements of those, but at the end of the day, it just feels different. I think that's what I appreciate about it.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's super sad. I just learned this today, actually, reading about it, but I didn't know Inger Stevens committed suicide a few years after this film.
Oh, really? I didn't know that either.
I think she's gorgeous in this, and I really like her as a character. And I like the love interest element between her and Dee Martin, but I was sad to read that. I mean, she passed a few years after this, I think.
Yeah, she wasn't very old.
Yep. Yeah,
35. Wow. Yikes.
Yeah, she's gorgeous. She's absolutely gorgeous in this thing.
Yeah, yeah. She reminded me of somebody, and I can't think of who it was. There was a moment there, a red hot moment where I had a Sandra Locke flashback. It was only a moment because I don't think Sandra Locke's a very good actress.
I was going to say, were you drinking heavily when you were watching this? Because I didn't pick a Sandra Locke vibe at all.
I think it was just the look, maybe. Not that she looked like her, but I think it was just the look or something, the blonde.
That's like saying you picked up a Clyde moment.
mean, yeah, right turn Clyde. That was it, yeah. Yes, you're right. She didn't. She only made a few films after this. I guess maybe she had mental health problems or something.
I think that's what it was. I think her roommate found her or something of that nature.
Wow.
If I remember correctly.
Born in Sweden, which, yeah, you know, makes sense with a name like Inger.
Inger.
Yeah. I wish I would have been named Inger.
You could carry it, man.
I think I could carry an Inger. I don't know what that means. It's so stupid. What are we talking about?
I don't know.
Is there anything else you want to say about the release? I mean, I guess the scan, you know, I know it looks really nice, but I know.
Yeah, it does. It's that typical like 4K scan. I know I haven't listened to it yet. I will, but it's got commentary track with author and film historian Brian Hannon. It's got a little short on there, Jack of all trades, film critic Walter Chaw and the film of Henry Hathaway. Another short, A Woman of True Grit, Lizzie Franke on screenwriter Marguerite Roberts' legacy. And again, the booklet in here that kind of talks about the release and the making of the film is really good too. And this is one of those that if people haven't bought from, I assume everybody who listens to your podcast has probably made a purchase from Vinegar Syndrome.
I would assume so.
Yeah. I mean, it's the standard release, but it does have a really nice slip cover. I got to say, I love the artwork on this release as well. It's really good. But
yeah, it's cool.
The inside is when you open it up, it has that green cover that was on my Paramount DVD when I bought it or something. So if you like that version, you can switch it. You
switch it around. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I love when they give you that option.
Yeah. It's a great release, man. And it's one of these where it's not bare bones. It's got a lot of meat to it. And if you like the film, I'd say it's definitely worth picking up.
Yeah. I'll probably pick it up on my next Vinegar Syndrome order, whenever that is. Probably won't be too long.
Tomorrow.
Probably won't be too long.
Come on. I know you.
I mean, Lady Reporter's coming out and, you know,
I know, God. It's I just Kino's got a sale going on right now, and I'm trying desperately not to go to the website.
I'm not even going there. I'm not going there.
I'm not either. I can't, but I will. I know I will.
I'm starting to get some Vincent points too, so I might get, you know, that obviously justifies me going there even more, right?
This is terrible. They know we have an addiction problem, and they just feed it.
Yeah,
where's your rewards card? Please don't. I mean,
need to make a movie like The Insider. Michael Mann's The Insider. We need to make a movie about these boutique labels.
Yeah.
Like, how do we get them? I got an idea. More Rothrock. That does it every time.
Oh, it does for me, man.
All right. Is that everything you got on Five Card Stud?
Yeah, absolutely, man.
All right. Let's see. Make or break for me. I'm going to go. I'm going to go with that moment with the, I love that moment with the windmill. I love that training sequence. I love how he moseys down on the horse and just gets off, and you kind of get the vibe that he's kind of coming down to be kind of macho at the same time, but you don't really think, I think, that they're going to come out of that moment as like a team. You kind of get the vibe that he's coming down there to do something else. By that point, you're starting to get some vibes about the character too.
Yeah. I like how it starts, because it starts with Dean Martin showing off like his shooting skills to Inger Stevens. And then Mitchum shows up and sort of outshoots him. But yeah, that's my make or break scene too, because I love the exchange between all three of them, and then even that dialogue. So I think, to me, it just solidifies the charm of this film that is sort of front and center to this whole mystery and even some of the gruesome elements.
Right, right. MVT, I'm going to kind of surprise you here. I'm going to go with Roddy McDowall on this one.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, I see it.
And I tell you why. At first, when I first started watching it, and I hadn't seen this film before, he kind of stuck out like a sore thumb. You know, Roddy McDowell's got a very distinct delivery.
Okay.
It's like, what are we doing here, fellas? You know, he has this really weird way of speaking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think he was English, right, originally? I think he ended up spending so much time in America that I think he kind of lost most of his English accent, I believe.
I think you're right, yeah.
So there's always that little bit of old English in there. And at first I thought, man, this isn't really going to work. Like, this isn't going to work for me. I could tell right away he was going to be mostly the heavy in the film. But I got to say, by the time we get to his kind of great moment in the graveyard and everything else, I really enjoyed his bad guy character. Like, yeah. I really enjoyed the moments he gave and what he was doing and how kind of conniving and shitty he was. And I mean that in the best possible way. These Westerns, and I kind of set this up earlier when we was talking about with my grandfather, you know, your bad guy's got to have he's got to have something. And I couldn't stop thinking of Roddy McDowall after watching this. So that's what I'm going to go with for my MVT.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Score, I'm going to go 7.5.
Okay.
You're going to be like, why didn't you go 8? But
no, look, I'm not having this debate with you.
If Sammo Hung would have been in here, I'd have gave it an 8.
Jesus.
7.5. But this is one first time watch, 7.5. I could see it maybe going up. You know, if I rewatch it and stuff, I could see it going up, because I really quite enjoyed it. And it is a breezy watch.
It is. Yeah.
It's nice and breezy.
It's over. By the time it's over, you're like, wow, that runs at it. I like your phrase. It runs at a good clip.
It runs a really good clip. I mean, it just kind of moves. And I never was bored. I never paused it. I never walked away. I watched the whole thing in one sitting. I mean, I love when films are 90 to 100 minutes and you just kind of sit there and suck them in and then move on.
Yeah.
But the pacing's got to be there for it, because if the pacing's off, I always know. If the pacing's off for me, a dead giveaway is pausing.
Oh, yeah. Mine, my butt cheek hurts. Like, yeah, I know I'm sitting too long.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, for me, it's pause. Oh, if okay. I start pausing, like if I pause to look at my phone, because I won't look at my phone and watch a movie, I'll pause and look at my phone and then unpause because I can't, my brain doesn't work that way. But if I pause to get something to eat or something to drink, that's totally different. But if I pause to kind of just walk around and like maybe put a few Blu-rays away in my cases or whatever,
yeah,
we got a pacing problem.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah,
Houston, we got a pacing problem here.
Well, I already said I agreed with you on that scene. Mm-hmm. I don't know. MVT, I'm going to go Dean Martin. Okay. So, and here's why. Because it isn't that sort of white hat character portrayal. It is very much a gray hat. So
yeah,
you're supposed to follow him. He is the cowboy detective. But just like in a traditional film noir, he makes some choices that you go, well, that's not exactly what a good guy would do. And, you know, the fact he's got two women that he's, you know, sort of messing around with. He's protecting Roddy McDowall for a good chunk of the film, which is really weird.
Mm-hmm.
But you understand why he's doing it, because he wants to get to the bottom of the mystery. But I love that he's got all of these sort of gray character choices and still manages to deliver that Dean Martin charm. And I think, you know, this is why I watch Dean Martin films is what he pulls off in things like this.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
My score, what's funny is my score is just a teensy bit higher. I would give it a 7.75. So, yeah, yeah, and, yeah. And it's funny, the first time I watched it, I probably would have given it like a 6 or something like that. And then the second time I watched it, oh, that's a good 7. With you, it's like every time I watch this, I find something new to appreciate about it. I guarantee when I sit down and listen to that commentary, I'm going to go 8, solid 8 all day long.
Yeah. 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 That, I mean, I could see it getting into that territory for me. I could see.
Yes. It, especially if a commentary comes back and just. There's something about a really good commentary. If it does its job right and heightens your appreciation of the film,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it definitely, if you're scoring it, it heightens your score, right?
Right, right. Yeah, it's a very solid Western, though. I'd recommend people check it out.
Absolutely.
They'll be entertained at the very least. I mean, it's old school, but it's got some nice kind of modern elements with some of the violence and the murder mystery stuff. So I think they'll like it. All right, that is the big show. Troy, what's going on over at Not a Bomb? I'm not on there lately.
Well, you're coming back.
I'm coming back soon, yes.
Yeah, we're taking movie science and we're celebrating April month with ape movies, but you know, we're doing more monkey movies than ape movies, but we explain it on the show why it all makes sense.
Yeah, you try to anyway. I admire your will to do that.
Hey, look, we did it and we're running with that logic. So we did Monkey Shines. I think next week we're going to talk about Conga. And then I think in a week or so, you and Jose are coming back on because we're going to talk about M, which is part of the Not a Bomb Classics series that we've been doing each month.
Yeah, I got to rewatch that. I haven't watched it in a while.
And then next month we're doing remakes for May, like Remake. See,
I'm in there. I'm coming in there.
Yeah, I picked one because I knew you wanted to talk about it, and I can't wait to talk about that one with you. I knew you would pick that one. So
yeah, you're baiting me now.
Yeah, I did 100%.
Yeah. I've said some things about that particular remake over the years that are a bit controversial.
I know, that's why I picked it. I'm like, I've got to hear him explain himself on this.
Yeah. And then I always get intimidated. I'm like, well, what if my explanation isn't good enough? But at the end of the day, if that's what you enjoy, that's what you enjoy. I have some reasons why I like it more, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Make sure you check out Not a Bomb. Make sure to check out Watch Skip Plus with our good friend Jose and Alex, MC Alex. Yes. Family, so to speak. Although he may have lost a little bit of clout with his recent thoughts on Godzilla X Kong. I know that
he's still my adopted son, even though what's funny is I love Alex to death. I mean, obviously I've watched him growing up, but the movies I've shown him, And then to hear him talk about that and go, yeah, Troy showed me all this stuff and I still didn't get into it. It disappoints me a little bit. He breaks my heart when he says that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what are you going to do, man? I mean, you know, we can only lead them down the path. We can't, you know.
Listen, if I ever want to get back to Alex, I have a video of him singing a Katy Perry song and dancing to it on some video game that is absolutely hilarious. I'll just, you know, he's supposed to visit in Baltimore. I may just find a way to show that on, like, I don't know, Camden Yards big screen or something. I'll take him to a baseball game. I'll be like, hey, look up there. Is that you dancing to Katy Perry?
I have a feeling you get a different score on that Godzilla X Kong after that.
It better be a 10.
Also, check out NOTLP, Mary Clicker, See Here. Love that album. Caliber 9 from Outer Space, kind of new guys on the block. I love those guys. Raiders of the Podcast, Feminine Critique, and John's channel. And now for something a little bit different. I believe that's what it's called.
Yes.
John, I love your channel, but I constantly want to call it And Now for Something Completely Different. Growing up being a Monty Python fan, I had to write it down because if I didn't write it down, I was going to keep calling it that.
Got a co-host now. It's really good.
Yeah. There's a Mike.
Yep,
Mike's on there. Yeah, Mike. Good old Mike. Mike's done a GGTMC episode before.
I thought so. Yeah, because when I saw him and heard his voice, I'm like, I know I've listened to him before.
Yeah, Mike's family. He's part of the family. I don't know what we're doing next week. Troy and me kind of got an idea what we might do, but we're going to have to let schedules permit that to happen and see what happens. We're busy fellas, and who knows? This took all the way to Thursday, and the original plan was Tuesday, I think. So
yeah, life happens.
But life happens. It does.
We got to talk about that movie. I'm just saying it's...
That particular one we picked?
Yeah, I swear to God,
don't say anything. People are going to know what it is. Well, we'll see. We'll see if we get to it. Either way, even if we don't get to it and Will comes back, we'll still invite you back on and we'll still do it.
Okay. Cause all right.
I haven't seen that one in forever. So
really? Okay.
Yeah. It's been a long time, but you know, in fairness, I hadn't seen Warriors 2 in a long time either.
In fairness, you need to rewatch that film and reevaluate yourself and maybe reevaluate your life choices. I don't know, but an 8? Come on, man.
I mean, I just think Prodigal Son's a better film.
Look, you can have 2 10s, all right?
Yes. Yes, you can. I'm not going to say anything there. A pair of 10s. All right. All right. So that's the big show. With that, I will say adios.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.